welcome to this week's edition of World Crisis Radio. This is your host, Webster Tarpley, here in Washington, D.C., and we have gotten to about, in terms of the 100 days of Barky Obama, the tenant of the White House, we have reached, about 2 weeks, a little bit more than 2 weeks left in the 100 days. The 100 days end on April 30th. And right now it's Good Friday, taping the show here on Friday afternoon in Washington. So a little bit more than 2 weeks, and this will be over. And what we'll try to do today is to go back and look at what's been going on. First of all, the question of Obama's foreign trip. Everyone will remember what we've been saying here for the past 14, 15 months. The whole point of Obama is to have a facelift for imperialism, cosmetic surgery for Anglo-American imperialism, take off the old discredited, hated face of the Bush-Cheney neocons and put on the smiling, charismatic, demagogic, left cover, new face of Obama. And the question is, how well does that work? Based on this first European outing, it does not work too well, and it's ominous. On the one side, it's good that there's resistance, reluctance to go along with Obama's lunatic policies. On the other hand, it also points again to the question of a return to false flag methods of the 9/11 variety by the U.S. and British ruling class to try to accomplish under the impact of false flag events, this time exploited from a left cover perspective, to obtain the things that they cannot obtain through the normal political process. So we must bear this in mind. And obviously, the moment that Obama walked into the White House, the door to false flag operations began to open wider and wider. But let's look at the defeats. I would say, all in all, there were two principal goals. There were two things that the U.S. ruling elite wanted out of this trip by Obama to Europe. And this was, first of all, more cannon fodder for Afghanistan. Remember, Obama's entire message is, I'm not George Bush. Look at me. I'm not a reactionary. I'm reasonable. I'm left of center. I'm a normal guy. Actually, I'm better than a normal guy. I'm a telegenic demagogue with lots and lots of left cover. And I have this messianic and utopian aspect about me, right? I'm the Messiah. I have a personality cult. I am the one. I am anointed and all the rest of this stuff. So the idea was basically to take that act to Europe and say to these characters, Merkel, Sarkozy, Berlusconi, and the rest of them, you have now got to come up with cannon fodder. We want the bodies of your troops to send into the Afghanistan meat grinder. And if you're not willing to send combat troops, then cough up big bucks. Now, that was that NATO meeting in the middle of Obama's trip to Europe. And the results, I think, are extremely meager. True to his profile as a warmonger, which is what Obama is underneath all of this rhetoric, he's basically continuing the same two wars under left cover, throwing off the discredited Bush-Cheney neocon cover and neocon rhetoric and war on terror, no more global war on terror, now overseas contingency operation. That's supposed to be politically correct left cover. So he's continuing the same wars but under left cover, and he's escalating Afghanistan. We've now got 17,000 combat troops plus 4,000 advisors for a total of 21,000 U.S. forces on their way to Afghanistan soon. So true to his election promises, which the left liberals heard but could never understand, Obama is indeed an imperialist warmonger, and he's sending these 21,000 troops into Afghanistan. And the big thing was to do a number on the Europeans, Canadians, and others at this NATO meeting and try to extort cannon fodder and money. The results, it looks like at the very most, something between 3,000 to 5,000 more forces, not combat troops in many cases, and may be forthcoming. And the problem is, because of the duplicity and deception postures that are being put on by all of these governments, because obviously this war is unpopular in the European public, as indeed it ought to be here, 3,000 to 5,000 more forces possible, but it's not clear whether those are new forces. In other words, whether they're pledging again what they've already pledged in the past and failed to deliver. And a good example, Gordon Brown, the Labour Party socialist, he really is a socialist, except, of course, he's a tool of the City of London financial complex. Gordon Brown says that he's willing to deliver up to 1,000 more British forces, up to 1,000, as many as 1,000, no more than 1,000, and maybe 100, maybe 50, maybe 20, maybe one, but only if others in Europe, presumably, also join in. So that doesn't look too good. That's not exactly a rousing result. We had Sarkozy saying, well, we have carried the day here with Obama because the strategy that will be employed by the NATO invaders in Afghanistan is going to be the European strategy, not the U.S. strategy, whatever this means. Once again, Afghanistan is the graveyard of imperialist arrogance and ambition. Ask the British Empire, the three Afghan wars, with at least one army absolutely wiped out, with one person surviving, and of course ask the Soviet Union, the Russian forces of the Red Army, who had a terrible experience in Afghanistan. It is the graveyard of imperialist ambition and arrogance. So that will not change. It will remain such a meat grinder and become so more and more. This is now Obama's war. Call Iraq Bush's war if you want. This is now Obama's war in Afghanistan. Of course, even more so, the question of Pakistan, where the Predator drones are flying every day and killing innocent civilians in the Northwest Territories, Waziristan, the tribally, federally administered tribal areas of Pakistan, with the goal of breaking Pakistan into pieces, right, four or five pieces, because the issue there, of course, is the energy corridor from the Persian Gulf, from the Arabian Sea, from the region of the Straits of Hormuz, practically, up to China, over the Himalayas, goes through Pakistan, in particular the port of Gwadar. So Pakistan can become one of the most important energy corridors, linking China to Iran and the rest of the Middle East, over land, beyond reach of the Anglo-American naval forces, which otherwise would try to interdict under all sorts of conditions. So that's the strategy that they're pulling. Doesn't look like it's working too well. Now, there was a meeting of Obama with Medvedev of Russia. Look for deception postures all around at this. Obama says he wants to work well with Russia. They want to reset the relations and so forth. The reality is what we've been saying over the past several months, that what Obama's trying to do here is to con Moscow into becoming the leading edge of efforts to pressure Iran on their nuclear program, various kinds of threats, blackmail, arm-twisting, strong-arming, and so forth. They want to get Russia to join in the effort so as to create frictions between Russia and Iran and try to build that into something over Obama's time in office. Back in a minute.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. Your host, Webster Tarpley, here in Washington, D.C. calling your attention to my latest book, Surviving the Cataclysm, Your Guide to the Worst Financial Crisis in Human History. We're putting the finishing touches on the paper edition. So if you've ordered that, please be patient. As I began talking about this, I guess it was 4 or 5 weeks ago, I said, give us 4 to 6 weeks and you'll have a paper copy. That will be the case, or approximately so. So the paper copy is in the final stages, so to speak. It's in the press. So in the meantime, go to www.progressivepress.com, progressivepress.com, if you haven't already done so, and order your copy. The book, which I think accurately predicted, forecast, outlined in advance the current financial breakdown crisis, pointing to the deindustrialization of the U.S. and the world, the ravaging effects of economic globalization, the hot money casino bubble economy, the massive decline in the U.S. standard of living, minus 50% by 1999, minus about two-thirds by today, compared to a Lyndon B. Johnson era late New Deal standard of living. And then the question of deregulation and the bubble economy, expressed above all in the form of derivatives, the derivatives plague. And as you know, derivatives are at the center of the current world economic depression. Derivatives, 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 credit default swaps, structured investment vehicles, collateralized debt obligations, auction rate securities, asset-backed securities, any kind of securitization, mortgage-backed securities, bundling, all this other stuff. What Obama thinks represents the real economy. This is an absolute plague. As Chirac, president of France, said, financial aids, well, get rid of it. They're like the Rasputniks. They have negative value. The only thing to do is to make them illegal, as they were between 1936 and 1982. Make derivatives illegal again. Re-ban, re-outlaw derivatives, and you have a perspective of getting out. So all of this contained in Surviving the Cataclysm, Your Guide to the Worst Financial Crisis in Human History. Also good advice on how to survive yourself. Those who bought the book 10 years ago, followed the advice, have done very well, have not been burned. They've done better than the Harvard Endowment under Larry Summers. Interesting point. The Harvard Endowment has lost 30% so far. Under Larry Summers, when he was president, he said to the Harvard investment management operation, managing this huge endowment, the largest of any private educational institution in the world, Larry Summers said, oh boy, I've just gotten out of the Clinton administration and I've legalized derivatives. And with the help of Phil Graham and Wendy Graham and Bob Rubin and Greenspan, we've started this massive derivatives bubble. So let's get in there and cash in. And of course, the Harvard Financial Authority, starting back in the early aughties when Summers was at the helm of Harvard, went massively into derivatives. And now, of course, they're assuming that they lost 30% of their endowment, minus one third on the Harvard endowment, a colossal loss, 10, 12 billion, whatever it is. But nobody knows how much it is. Only on June 30th, 2009, will we know the full amount. Well, we think we may know that they've lost. They won't know themselves. Let's put it that way. They will not know how much they've lost until June 30th, 2009, and all these second quarter results come in. So anyway, if you bought Surviving the Cataclysm in 1999 or 2000 or 2001, followed the advice in it, you did better than the Harvard Endowment under Larry Summers and the derivatives merchants and hedge funds, hyenas and jackals and assorted creatures. We also have Obama the Postmodern Coup, the making of a Manchurian candidate, indispensable on the foreign policy side, the trilateral Bilderberg side, related issues concerning Obama, and then the detailed compendium, Barack H. Obama, The Unauthorized Biography. Two books on Obama published during 2008. The most alarming development in presidential politics since Jimmy Carter, and probably more so than Jimmy Carter, given the fact that this crisis is qualitatively worse. So those are available on Amazon.com. Obama the Postmodern Coup and Barack H. Obama, The Unauthorized Biography. Get those on Amazon. And right now, Surviving the Cataclysm, available from ProgressivePress.com at www.progressivepress.com. I also urge everybody to get the Obama Deception from Alex Jones over at InfoWars, various cameo appearances by me, but the main thing is a very effective documentary, one of the best political documentaries to come out of the United States in many, many a moon, and it's the key to understanding the Obama phenomenon and indeed turning the tide, and there will be more developments on that front over the next couple of months. So those are the things that I recommend, and let's now get back to evaluating Obama's foreign tour. So on Afghanistan and Pakistan, the results are very poor. Even Britain says up to 1,000, provided more countries send other troops. Canada is sticking to their policy, I believe, of getting out. 3,000 to 5,000 at the very most is all that Obama was able to get out of the whole European NATO contingent plus Canada. So that's not good. They're also promising that there will be no invasion of Pakistan, says Obama. No invasion of Pakistan, in effect. Well, it's already happened, and acts of war against Pakistan happen every day. And indeed, some months ago, they sent in various kinds of special forces for these raids. Concerning the diplomatic developments around this, notice also there was this conference in The Hague at the end of March, a conference on Afghanistan. This is the Hillary Clinton Holbrooke Petraeus clique, which seems to dominate policy in this area. And this was a policy conference on Afghanistan. And the big deal here was that a middle-ranking Iranian foreign ministry official showed up and met with the conference going on there. So there's a charm offensive vis-a-vis Iran, of course, because they want to, in conformity with the Brzezinski Doctrine, they would like to recruit Iran as an ally. And, of course, if you look at what has happened in Iraq over the last 2 years, the so-called surge and the success of the surge, it's the success of an under-the-table deal with Iran, which has immobilized the Mahdi army and other Iranian forces inside Iraq. That has been the key to it, not any military strategy by this paperclip General Petraeus. So charm offensive towards Iran, charm offensive towards the Russians, lots and lots of deception operations. That's the Barkey foreign policy. We'll be back in a minute.
This is the GCN Radio Network.
Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. Webster Tarpley here in Washington, D.C. Wrapping up now on the foreign policy side of Obama's European tour. Notice he now says he wants a nuclear-free world. This is, of course, pure demagogy. This is a posture directed against places like Iran, but any third world country that wants to secure national independence, dignity, and economic development by having nuclear reactors, power reactors, peaceful uses of nuclear energy. Obama will now beat them over the head with the idea that they are actually proliferating. This is pure Jimmy Carter. You'll remember one of the centerpieces of the Carter administration debacle was a very, very militant anti-nuclear policy by Carter, by the Trilateral Commission people who were the majority of that administration, be it Carter, Mondale, Vance, Blumenthal, just the whole crew, all of them trilaterals, all handpicked by Zbigniew Brzezinski and David Rockefeller. Carter got into a huge fight with Germany about exporting nuclear reactors to Brazil. You can read about this in Obama the Postmodern Coup. Obama the Postmodern Coup has a 30 to 40 page history of the Carter administration built in, because that is the prototype for Obama, except, you know, to the 10th power worse. The idea of the nuclear-free world basically says, if you're a developing country, you will be denied nuclear energy, you will be denied modern technology, modern capital goods, and, of course, energy independence, because the Anglo-Americans always figure they can control oil, they can control coal. Therefore, if you don't have nuclear, they have you. That is what the French understood, for example, back in the 1970s, as a kind of a continuation of the de Gaulle attempt to assert independence in France. So, pure demagogy, and I don't think anybody's going to believe it. You think the Russian Federation is going to believe this, or that China will, that Obama wants a nuclear-free world? I think not. But it is now this form of extreme utopian left-cover demagogy that he needs. He's constantly struggling to maintain the facade of left-cover, when in reality the policies are the same naked imperialist blackmail, aggression, and arrogance. So that's the one side. Now, the second thing on the tour, of course, is the economic side. Once again, we're back to Carter. Obama demanded that the Europeans engage in inflationary to hyperinflationary stimulus along the lines of what Obama is doing here in the U.S. What it basically comes down to is he wants the European Central Bank to radically lower the interest rates in Europe so that the euro is not going to become a vehicle to expose the weakness of the dollar. In other words, the idea is he's saying to the Europeans, you guys debase your currency, you destroy the euro in the same way that I'm destroying what's left of the dollar. And that way, the euro will not begin to reflect the tremendous weakness of the dollar. In other words, if everybody goes into inflation at the same time, it won't be so evident. We'll try to keep the system balanced. This goes back, of course, to Volcker's great fear, right, which is the mudslide. Once the dollar begins to fall, says Volcker, and you can read about this in Surviving the Cataclysm. This was what Volcker did for about 20 years of his life, was to try to prevent the dollar from going into the tank. Once the dollar begins to slide, it's very hard to stop it. And they're always afraid of this, so they're trying to get out in front. Now, it's interesting because you go back to Carter Mondale, end of 76, beginning of 77. They had exactly the same thing, the locomotive theory, they called it. Mondale was sent on a world tour even before Carter was inaugurated. Vice President-elect Mondale of the Trilateral Commission, stooge and running dog of Brzezinski and David Rockefeller and the rest of the Trilateral gang, was sent to Germany and other countries in Europe and Japan saying, you have got to start stimulating. You have got to get the world economy going by essentially an easy money reflation policy. And again, same idea, that the dollar, of course, in those days was catastrophically weak as it has remained. But they wanted to make sure that the competition of a strong foreign currency didn't reveal and expose the weakness of the dollar. Now, on that one, they didn't get anywhere. There was no success on the locomotive theory, no success on the idea that the Europeans should lower interest rates, go to a 0% policy, and pump something like 10 trillion or 12 trillion of their own into the financial system. So that leaves us now with this question of hyperinflation. The euro, of course, has its ups and downs. There's plenty of rottenness in Europe. Europe is also, to a large degree, a post-industrial economy, although not quite as bad as the U.S. in most countries. Britain probably worse than the U.S., but the continentals, Germany, Italy, and France, probably somewhat better off in terms of maintaining some kind of an industrial base, because these, remember, are countries that cannot simply run prolonged deficits and export their currency the way the U.S. does. They've got to produce things that people want to buy so as to procure foreign exchange to buy the things that they need on the world market. So that is hyperinflation now hanging over the world scene. And whenever you see the stock market begin to go up, as it has over the last month or so, you've always got to ask yourself, is that now this entire thing changing gears out of the deflationary mode, which prevailed during much of the second half of 2008, changing from that deflationary mode and back into a hyperinflationary mode? Obviously, these things take a bit longer right now because you're dealing with a world system. In other words, it's a globalized system, which it truly has a worldwide looting base. So if it's going to be hyperinflation, it may not be as rapid as some people expect. But I think that is at least a very, very likely outcome, barring some unforeseen circumstance, because the whole thing could, of course, it could go into some kind of a panic crash at just about any time as a result of some outside event. These are also contingencies that are dealt with in surviving the cataclysm, your guide to the worst financial crisis in human history. Now, then we also have the ineptitude of Obama, third point. Obama is truly unqualified to be president. Imagine making a speech when you come out and say, I am not naive. People can remember, I am not a crook. That was, of course, the leading crook, Richard Nixon, who said it. Nixon, of course, more of a victim of the CIA and Kissinger and their Watergate coup d'etat than anything else. But I am not a crook. I am not naive, says Obama. I am not naive. Now, I think the big mistakes in this tour come down to the kowtows. Kowtowing to foreign tyrants, not good. A neck bow for Queen Elizabeth II. This is the queen of colonialism. This is the queen of imperialism. This is the queen of the British Empire and her family, of course, thoroughly pro-Nazi during the 1930s, as long as they could get away with it, right? Her uncle, Edward VIII, the Nazi king, had to be gotten out of the picture because of his friendship for Hitler, his admiration for Hitler. Her uncle, Edward VIII, was somebody who would have been the viceroy of a Nazi puppet state in the British Isles if Hitler had successfully invaded. So that's not good stuff. Kowtowing to the queen with a neck bow, very, very bad. And then, of course, even more spectacular, the full kowtow to King Abdullah of Saudi Arabia, who, of course, as I had occasion to write about some years ago, this is a place where household slavery is still practiced. In other words, that guy has slaves in the same way that the Emir of Kuwait has slaves. You can read some things that I wrote about this during the first Gulf War. Saudi Arabia and Kuwait, homes of slavery. Back in a minute on World Crisis Radio.
The GCN Radio Network, providing the world with hard-hitting talk radio. GCN, great talk radio starts here.
Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. Webster Tarpley here in Washington, D.C. So Obama's kowtows to the crowned heads, the foreign tyrants, neck bow for Queen Elizabeth II, Queen of Colonialism, and then the full Monty for King Abdullah, slave-holding potentate of Saudi Arabia. This is very bad. It shows, I think, a lack of a sense of the state. The state, the nation state. The United States, a nation state based on the rejection of monarchy and the rejection of monarchism. And today, of course, we have our left monarchists coming out saying, oh, this was no good to kowtow to King Abdullah, the right-wing monarchists, left monarchists are defending Obama. That of course, it was not a bow. He was just being polite to the king of Saudi Arabia. And the right wing now, they've discovered anti-monarchism, except a lot of the right wingers are saying, oh, he should have bowed more to Queen Elizabeth because she's better than King Abdullah. So we have our left-wing monarchists and right-wing monarchists. And, of course, the American system says no to monarchy, no to monarchism in any form. How can you be a left-wing monarchist? That seems to be what Obama is trying to do. His touching concern for the public image of these two monarchs is obviously total violation of U.S. Tradition. It shows Obama's inability to be the symbol of a great nation. I don't think he does not believe in nations. Remember, oligarchs, be they left oligarchs or right oligarchs, don't believe in the nation state. That's the whole trick. The left oligarch doesn't believe in the nation state, thinks it's a bad thing. And the right-wing oligarch, same thing, under this anarcho point of view, the Austrian and Chicago outlook. So that, of course, is a disaster. One other point on the foreign policy stuff, North Korea. North Korea sets off a three-stage rocket, and Obama says, they broke the rules. Wait a minute, Obama. What rules? What rules are you talking about? You're talking about these UN Security Council resolutions passed under people like John Bolton? Is that what you're referring to as the rules? As the Russians correctly pointed out, all states have equal rights to the peaceful use of space. And if North Korea, the DPRK, wants to put a satellite into orbit, that is their sovereign right. I would say the idea here is the traditional use of North Korea, of course, is to keep Japan and South Korea in line, that is, subservient to the U.S. It's always good to have a crisis involving North Korea because this forces Japan and South Korea back into the U.S. orbit because it's, after all, the U.S. that's going to protect them against the evil forces of Pyongyang. It's also an embarrassment to China, and it's a problem for Russia. So the North Korean gambit seems to be played again and again at the time that that this is convenient for the U.S. So all in all, the trip is a failure in terms of substance. It's a failure on getting troops and money and cannon fodder for Afghanistan. Europeans have basically punted on that, and even the pledges they've given they probably won't fulfill. And on the stimulus, the easy money, debasing the euro so the debasement of the dollar won't be quite so obvious, that's also a failure. And I think it may be a success in terms of some demagogy, American cable television, but the idea, I am not naive, kowtowing to the crowned heads, the problems that this has generated in the long run, I think, are going to be quite serious. Now, that leads us to the dynamics of the 100 days. As you will find if you look in Obama, the postmodern coup, look in that history of the Carter administration, you will see that Carter peaked shortly after the end of the 100 days, sometime in May of 1977 was Carter's best public opinion ratings, and then it all began to fall apart. And he did have some blips up when hostages were taken, the sort of rally round effect. But other than that, it was a straight decline down into the sub-Bush levels, down to 25-27%, down to sort of Truman levels, Truman being the most hated president of the post-war period in terms of public opinion polling. So Obama's 100 days, of course, not like Roosevelt at all, not like Roosevelt in 1933, but like Napoleon in 1815, headed towards Waterloo. Now, given that fact, watch out for false flag. We do begin to pick up these blips. A couple of weeks ago, we had this incident of a U.S. spy ship off the coast of China and some Chinese vessels coming around and engaging in harassing tactics. Now we have the question of this Maersk, Alabama freighter attacked by Somalian pirates off the coast of Somalia, the captain held hostage. Here again, Obama's ineptitude overwhelming. He's got a photo opportunity, and they ask him about the pirates, and he says, guys, we came here to talk about housing, or we came here to talk about transportation. This is not good, right? The studied indifference to the life of this captain, very bad. So I think we can assume, based on this, that Obama will crater. It's obvious that his economic policies will not work. So when he begins to slide, what's going to happen? And at that point, you think about these Chinese ships, you think about the pirate incidents, you think about a few other things that have gone on, the North Korean missile launch, You're getting the feeling that false flag may be in the offing, that there may be an attempt to stage something, and it's time for people to become vigilant and observant and analytical on that front. Now, in terms of the economics, this is an absolute disaster. We have this Geithner plan, right? We talked about it last week. The public-private partnership means the fascist corporate state. The essence of fascist economics, the state-sponsored compulsory cartel for the purpose of driving down production, driving down wages, and propping up bloated, speculative values of bubble instruments, derivatives in this case. So Geithner, Tiny Tim, the tax cheat, Geithner has now come out with the PPPIP, Public-Private Partnership Investment Program, which essentially gets the U.S. government into the hedge fund business, as we pointed out. With this 6-to-1 leverage, the hedge fund operator can leverage U.S. government money for the purpose of propping up derivatives. The U.S. government will be stuck with totally worthless, actually negative value, Rasputnik derivatives that should never have been legal. And they will laugh all the way to the bank. Now, they're going to name partners in this. Goldman Sachs will obviously be a partner, Morgan Stanley a partner. Hedge funds can be partners. Hedge funds. George Soros can be a partner. He can get his money back that he paid into Barkey's campaign coffers, and so on and so on and so on. It's an absolute disaster. The Obama's economic policies have now been attacked by an impressive array of economists, whatever you think of them. These are names that are known. Paul Krugman has attacked. Robert Reich has attacked. Joseph Stiglitz has attacked. Galbraith has attacked. Jeffrey Sachs, of all people, getting into the act with two attacks. The problem with all of these critiques is they don't tell you what to do. It's easy to see what to do. How did AIG get into trouble? Well, it was a hedge fund selling derivatives. You want to make sure that doesn't happen again? It's easy. Outlaw hedge funds, outlaw derivatives. Simple. We got along just fine for many, many decades with higher rates of economic growth, a better situation in the middle class, and a higher standard of living when there were no hedge funds and no derivatives. We don't need them. We don't need these new products. Derivatives, once again, illegal. From 1936 to 1982, make them illegal again and do it retroactively. Use the Defense Production Act and indeed the Trading with the Enemy Act, always fun, to shred, wipe out, destroy, delete, burn, plaster derivatives. Get them off the books. People watching CNBC might have seen the head of the London ICE Exchange, a guy called Sprecher. He wants to become the world market for credit default swaps. Don't let it happen. Wipe them out. Back soon. Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. Your host, Webster Tarpley, here in Washington, D.C. And we're looking at the perspective of the end of the 100 days of Barkey Obama, the tenant of the White House. What I think a lot of people have understood now over the past couple of weeks is that my diagnosis of about 14 to 15 months ago was absolutely realistic. This is the tenant of the White House most controlled by Wall Street in recent U.S. history. Maybe the most controlled by Wall Street since who? Since Coolidge? Since Grover Cleveland? It's hard to say. A total Wall Street puppet. And what I mean by that is the oil patch, forget it. They don't count for anything. Military industrial, it's a joke. Look what he's doing to General Motors and Chrysler. Forget military industrial. Forget biotech. Forget pharma. Forget Silicon Valley. Forget agriculture. Forget unions. They're going to be busted. The UAW will be busted. The American Federation of Teachers busted. And other unions busted after that. Like the air traffic controllers. If you get rid of the UAW and the AFT, then the rest is probably fairly easy. It is a Wall Street dictatorship, in effect. It is the rule of finance capital with no other interest being taken into account. Even Clinton the Clinton administration had to take into account what the feminists, right, National Organization for Women, various commitments that they had in those quarters. Here, nothing of the sort. Pure finance capital. Finance capitalists only need apply, and everybody else is outside. So we've got Krugman, Reich, Stiglitz, Galbraith, Sachs, and others all criticizing Obama, but not telling you how to get out of a depression. And again, the answer is outlaw hedge funds, wipe out derivatives under the Geithner PPPIP, public-private partnership investment programs. Hedge funds are going to merge into the new corporate state, the Wall Street fascist corporate state, and they're going to get federal money to buy up worthless derivatives. So they're pumping money into Goldman Sachs from three or four different quarters, through AIG, through the TARP. Of course, Goldman now says that they can give back their TARP money. I suppose they can, because they got it all through AIG, and they're going to take part now in the PPPIP. So this is Wall Street, people. This is not the New Deal. It's the anti-New Deal. It's not Roosevelt. It's the anti-Roosevelt. And let us point out now the politics of this. Once again, we see the Obama regime trying to set up a thing where you can choose between Obama and these right-wing troglodytes. And people have got to understand this. Every time you attack Obama, you say that he's a socialist, that he's giving money to the poor, that he's helping the deadbeats who should have been homeless but instead got subprime mortgages. You're helping him. Those attacks make him stronger. Those attacks give him left cover. This is a depression. In a depression, the political trump card is economic populism, left-wing economic populism, to be sure. But economic populism is Trump. If you look at these right-wing protests, this Tea Party movement, this is done from the point of view of Milton Friedman. This is the Chicago School speaking, right, that the Obama administration is taxing people to give money to welfare victims and the poor. This is not what he's doing. And if you create the impression that this is what he's doing, you are helping him. Talk about the $10 trillion that have gone to the banks. Don't talk about the $20 billion that went for food stamps or the $40 billion that went for extended unemployment benefits, because that is chump change. Focus on the big bucks, not the chump change. The dynamic of Obama is that if you want to attack him successfully, you must attack him from the left. Any other attack makes him stronger. Examples. During the campaign, notice that Obama was always talking about Hannity. Sean Hannity this, Sean Hannity that. Why? He wants to set up a situation where you can choose between the smiling, telegenic face of the trilateral demagogue Obama on the one hand and the discredited right-wing economy and foreign policy of somebody like Hannity. Hannity, of course, a discredited right-wing quasi-neocon, the hated face of the Bush administration. Why does Obama talk about Bush all the time? This now became an issue. Karl Rove is attacking Biden. We've also got Jeb Bush. Jeb Bush is attacking Obama, saying, lay off my brother. Why are you always attacking my brother, George W. Bush? We've got Rove feuding with Biden, calling him a blowhard and a liar because Biden had been attacking the Bush administration. You can see how this works. Does it come down to a choice between Obama and Bush? Is that really a metaphysical choice? Is that all there is in the world? From here on this program, we say, a plague on both your houses. That's a Hobson's choice. You're damned if you do and damned if you don't. What is needed is a New Deal alternative. Now, notice McCain. How could he have won the election? By getting to Obama's left and attacking him from there. The opportunity, as I pointed out at the time, I wrote as much as I could about this during one critical week of October. In order to stop Obama, get to his left, vote against the stimulus, the bailout, vote against the bailout of the banks, vote against the so-called TARP, as it has then been called. the first bailout, the $700 billion for Wall Street. If McCain had voted against that, he would have had a very good opportunity to defeat Obama. He could have pounded Obama mercilessly. You're a tool of Wall Street. You gave the biggest pork barrels and the biggest earmarks to your Wall Street friends. Wall Street owns you. You're bought and paid for by Wall Street. Soros and David Rockefeller and Blankfein and Mac and Diamond and Pandit and Lewis, they tell you what to do, Obama, and don't make any promises, Obama, because you've given away all the money to Wall Street. The $700 billion you just gave to Wall Street was the money that could have been used for health care, jobs, housing, urban mass transit, infrastructure, and all the rest of it. That would have been an effective attack because of the chains of stupid, backward, right-wing ideology, and also other chains on somebody like McCain. He didn't do it. But it's a case in point. If you want to defeat Obama, get to his left, attack him from there. And that's where we've been here the whole time, attacking Obama from his left. Not that he's a socialist, that he's a fascist, that it's the fascist corporate state, that it's not the rule of socialism, it's the rule of Wall Street. And this, of course, has the advantage of also being real. We've got Congressman Backus now takes us back to Joe McCarthy. These are all attacks that make Obama stronger. Congressman Backus says he has a list of 17 socialists that are hidden in the Democratic Party caucus in the House of Representatives. 17 socialists. Who could they be? Maybe Nancy Pelosi. Is she a socialist? Her office is run by Soros. Soros has an agent, a resident controller in Pelosi's office. Pelosi does what Soros orders. You call that socialism? Socialism, of course, means state control, government ownership of the means of production. And as we've pointed out many times here, it's very hard to do that in the United States because there are almost no means of production left. They've been destroyed by the post-industrial society. Obama is now in the process of destroying the last assembly lines we have, the Detroit ones, the GM, Ford, and Chrysler. Without those assembly lines, this is a banana republic. This is a shattered hulk. This is a ravaged derelict floating on the waters of adventure and economic depression. And, of course, socialism also has something to do with the working class. And Obama's program for the working class is to drive down wages, to bust the UAW, to bust the American Federation of Teachers. So if you want to keep attacking him as a socialist who's helping the poor, go ahead. You're helping him. You're making him stronger. Get to his left. Attack him from there.
Are you tired of searching for great talk radio? Search no more. We are the GCN Radio Network.
Radio, Webster Tarpley in Washington, pointing again to the charade, the farce that is being performed before our eyes. We've got Newsweek and others telling us that Obama is the new Franklin D. Roosevelt. He is the anti-Franklin D. Roosevelt, that we're now in a new deal. We've got Gordon Brown, the stooge of the city of London, right? Gordon Brown, who works for the counting houses and the Bank of England, telling us that he wants a global New Deal. What he wants is a global anti-New Deal. The New Deal is about payments to individuals who need it in order to get by, plus effective measures for economic recovery. The New Deal is not about payments to bankers. Obama is about payments to bankers by a margin of 30 to 40 to 50 to 1, depending on how you want to count it. But by a lopsided majority, it's the bankers who benefit from Obama, not the people. Therefore, to attack him as a tribune of the people, a friend of the masses, the savior of the poor, who wants to tax the middle class, this is absolute fatuous stupidity. And this, of course, is the problem. Now, we have this protest movement against Obama. justifiable. Many people of goodwill being drawn into it. But now the Tea Parties, what I've seen of the Tea Parties is the following, that they are heavily infiltrated by the Republican Party. They're heavily infiltrated by right-wing foundations, right? They're heavily infiltrated by people like the American Enterprise Institute, the Council on Foreign Relations, the Heritage Foundation, the Cato Institute, and so forth. You've had tea parties where Joe the Plumber shows up. You've got right-wing radio talk show hosts, the clones of Rush Limbaugh. This is a mechanism of social control. In other words, if everything can be forced into this template or paradigm, you choose between Obama and Limbaugh, Hannity, and the rest of them. That is a prison house of the mind from which you do not escape. And the whole point of this program is to remind people what is urgently needed is a left wing. It's a moderate, certainly moderate, traditional left wing alternative, a New Deal economic populist alternative to Obama that would combine these traditions of Alexander Hamilton, Friedrich List, the Careys, Lincoln, Franklin D. Roosevelt, John F. Kennedy, the populists, some elements of the progressive era, also some positive ones, and put that together in a framework which is protectionist, mercantilist, and dirigist. In other words, what the U.S. has been. Friedmanites and the Austrians talk to us about some kind of a dream time when the founding fathers in the dream time were all wonderful supporters of the free market. This never existed. It's a fraud. Alexander Hamilton is the main founding father in economic terms. It's the protective effect of the First Bank of the United States, the report on the bank, the report on the public debt, report on manufacturers, and the promotion of internal improvements and scientific development at public, federal expense. That's Alexander Hamilton. And unfortunately, the Jeffersonian alternative to that is the one that leads into bankruptcy. That is what Jefferson spoke in favor of was the policy of Lord Shelburne of Great Britain, which was to prevent the industrialization of North America, to keep the United States in a position of subservience to British manufacturers and to have certainly an agricultural paradise that wouldn't be a paradise. It would sooner or later become looking more and more like the Confederate States of America. No paradise, but hell on earth from just about every point of view. So it doesn't make any sense to attack Obama with this right-wing, discredited claptrap, but that is what is being done. This Joe the Plumber stuff, it doesn't, not only is it not effective, it doesn't get you anywhere. Look at somebody like Grover Norquist at the Anti-Tax Federation over there, the main neocon on economic policy, and they're making comeback now. Grover Norquist and his crew can make a comeback through these tea parties with their ideology. So not good, not good. And if you want to go out against the Fed, make it nationalize the Fed and turn it into an engine of cheap or 0% free federal credit, federal lending for economic development, for industrial and agricultural purposes only, not for speculation, not for narcotics, boys. Always a favorite theme among some of these people, the narcotics angle, and so forth. So that is the current situation. We've got to promote the emergence of a economic populist New Deal alternative, which is clearly coming at Obama from his left. And it's not hard to do. We've talked in previous programs. The attempt of radical environmentalists, of fanatics of the Malthusian stripe, to destroy agriculture in the California Central Valley qualifies as a high crime against humanity under the Nuremberg Code. We're getting more attention now in the press here against vis-a-vis Holdren. Holdren is the White House science advisor. This is a mockery. The man is an obscurantist. He is anti-science to the core, and his policy is known as de-development. Well, isn't that interesting? Here we are in an economic depression with 13 million officially unemployed, in reality 20 to 25 million. And we've got our principal industries either long since destroyed or shutting down now. We've got levels of industrial employment which are lower than they were in any time since the 19th century. And we've got, instead of a science advisor in the White House, we've got a quack and a charlatan who talks about de-development. And again, the Nuremberg overtones of this kind of stuff are quite obvious. So that's the problem. What are you going to do with that? That's got to be attacked from a New Deal pro-industrialist point of view. Now, we've also let's also remember on the derivatives front, right? As we look at this, the question of what should happen with the credit default swaps. As I said, we had Sprecher. Sprecher is the head of the London ICE exchange, and you'll remember them. The ICE was why you paid $4 to $5 per gallon of gas back in the summer of last year. The ICE was created by Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley, and that is where, in a deregulated British setting with a regulatory regime that's even worse than in the U.S., if that's imaginable, the ICE, Intercontinental Exchange, was the area of that. And we had Sprecher come on the CNBC program this week saying that they, as a result of the Group of 20 conference, there's a commitment in theory to have a market of credit default swaps by the end of this year, and the ICE wants to be that. Well, don't allow it. It's time for re-regulation, time to ban hedge funds, and time, above all, to ban and delete all outstanding derivatives. Don't take it from me. Take it from Myron Scholes, who says, blow up and burn out derivatives. Senator Warner, a bright line prohibition may be needed. Back in a minute.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Back to World Crisis Radio, Webster Topley in Washington, and of course, no edition of this program would be complete without a report from Phil Berg, who is leading the legal effort to expose the question of Obama's non-qualification for the presidency. So we're joined by Phil Berg. Are you there, Phil?
Yes, I am. How you doing?
Wonderful. Well, you know our routine here. What we'd like to hear from you every week is an update on what you're doing, and I see that you've sent out a press release, I think, over the last 48 hours. Tell us what's going on.
Well, in the press release, I basically stated that the Hollister case, which is the case of the retired Air Force colonel, the case was dismissed, and in my press release, which people can read themselves on ObamaCrimes.com, ObamaCrimes.com, I said the opinion is so outrageous, and then he ordered sanction imposed against our Washington, D.C. Attorney of a reprimand, and I said that was totally unfair. And the judge has showed his total bias ever since this case was filed. We are now on appeal to the District of Columbia Court of Appeals, and hopefully we can get better justice there. But in this particular case, we filed for pro hoc vici, which meant that admission to the court in a special instance, because I'm not a member of the D.C. federal court, the pro hoc vici all across our country, all across the great United States. And this judge decided he's going to hold mine and the co-counsel from Arizona's petition in abeyance until we came in front of him and he analyzed us and analyzed the court case, and he never scheduled a hearing. So I think he showed his bias right away in this case. But the case is now on appeal. Also, the judge in the case, Judge James Robertson, aside from denying that, he, and by doing that, our stuff, any notices only went to our local attorney, who is a nice gentleman. He's 82. He's not computer savvy. So the judge issued one order, giving us 2 days to respond, another order, 1 day to respond, but we never got the orders. We're thankful that listeners gave them to us. And the judge, in his opinion, we've been talking all along here of the fact that our position is that Obama is not constitutionally qualified and that he's not constitutionally eligible to be president. We because the U.S. Constitution provides that you must be natural born. Well, Judge Roberson kept refers in his decision to a new term in the efforts to justify Obama's citizenship. He talks about native born. So I think there's definitely grounds here for the appeal. He also said that our interpleader case was frivolous, a decision that we completely differ with. And then he called one of your favorite words. He referred to myself and Attorney Joyce as agents provocateurs. And actually, I'm honored by this designation because it shows that we're determined to expose the hoax of Obama. And that's the greatest hoax upon the citizens of the United States in the history of our country. Excuse me, that's over 230 years. In addition to that, we are proceeding with the case under seal, which I cannot discuss. And hopefully in the next month we'll be able to talk further on that. Matter of fact, maybe later this month. In addition to that, we have the case which I was originally filed back on August 21st, 2008, where the federal judge in Philadelphia dismissed the case stating I did not have standing. He said, for the listeners, I didn't have standing, and Webster, you don't have standing, and no one has standing. And it's
up to
Congress in the future to determine who would have standing, which is absurd, because even under the Constitution, you know, I think the 10th Amendment goes back, if nothing else, it goes back to we the people, and I represent we the people. So in that case, is we took the U.S. Supreme Court asking for some injunctions. We're not granted. They decided not to hear the case at that point, but the case is still alive and well. It's in the Third Circuit Court of Appeals, which sits in Philadelphia, but it's for Philadelphia, New Jersey, and Delaware. We've now been given a tentative schedule for oral argument in the last week of May of this year. So I'm encouraged that one of these days something's going to come through. I'm not encouraged by the fact that and my press release was delayed getting out because I've been on trial. I'm not encouraged by one of the other attorneys out there who's just doing all kinds of crazy things. We have to stay focused. And for your listeners, and we're putting out, we have to stay very focused on what the issue really is. The issue is Barack Obama natural born? There's one attorney out there. She's doing anything for press, but then, in my opinion, it nullifies our point with the general public out there. By right now, one of her recent things was she wrote to the FBI and CIA that they should investigate our United States Supreme Court because they're hiding documents, the clerks hiding documents for the justices. I don't buy any of those arguments. And I think she should go back to, she's also a dentist, she should go back to practicing dentistry. But I'm encouraged. We get, right now we're at about a million hits a day on our website. Sorry for the delay in updating. It's just been, I've had a heavy schedule. But we are determined, and we're going to do a court warrant one of these days. I know a couple other attorneys have stolen my idea, but I don't care, and filed those. But ours is going to be better. I really feel that we're going to keep going forward. The Tea Parties are coming up next week, and we've been trying to latch on to them. I saw someone, I'm not sure if it came from the National or someone else, had a sign asking people to bring signs to the rallies, and one of the signs that they asked to bring was a sign saying, Mr. Obama, show us your birth certificate. So
very good.
I think that group needs me as much as I need them, actually more so, because if they want to talk about Constitution and taxation, all that, there's nothing more important than just going back to the article regarding who should be president. And Barack Obama does not meet those qualifications. And I think that would be in the best interest of those individuals. So if any of them are listening, I'm going to cooperate with you on the things coming up for the taxes this coming week. Other than that, people go to our website, spread the word, send it to everyone on your address book. Ask them to spread it. We have to get more people aware of the fact that he's a phony, and which means that, you know, and that's why I happen to look, I really don't want to, but I happen to look at TV when he and Michelle are getting off the plane in these various countries, and I think they're smiling on their faces because they're laughing to themselves like that the big fools in this are the American citizens who believed in him as this candidate of change, the transparent government, and he's not even transparent enough to show the facts and figures from himself. So I think that, you know, one of these days you have to wake up. The market was dropping. It looks like it's picking up. But when the American public sees that he's not what he says, he's not this candidate of change. Over in Europe, he didn't do that well over there. I think it was a total insult when he bowed to the Saudi Arabian king. And That was right. A total insult to the citizens in this country. And even Michelle Obama, putting her arm around the Queen, you know, they, someone in there should teach them protocol, a certain protocol. But it seems that protocol doesn't matter to Obama. Obama just wants to do whatever he wants to do. And I even think he gave the iPhone or whatever he gave to the Queen. Is ridiculous. I mean, I think that his protocol, it just shows that he doesn't care about the citizens of this country or really what people think of him around the world.
Certainly not. And Phil, I want to compliment you, especially on the idea of going to these tea parties. I was discussing the question of the tea parties. The content of that has got to be provided. And if people like you and others don't get involved, then it's going to be provided by the Heritage Foundation, by the American Enterprise Institute, by Grover Norquist, and indeed by the Republican Party, because that's what it's going to come down to. And the idea of using the Tea Party to put this question of Obama's non-qualification for the presidency, I think is very good. Because what are they going to argue? You can't bring that to our Tea Party? So then they're running interference for Obama if they say that. So I hope that will happen. And concerning this charming lady that we've been discussing, her idea of attacking the Supreme Court, this is you get to a point where you wonder, does she make up these crazy tactics because she's inept, or is there some darker reason that's going on? Anyway, Phil, thanks for being with us. I know you're very pressed for time, so we're going to let you go. That was Phil Berg from ObamaCrimes.com. Go to that site and give him a contribution to further this great work. We'll be back in a minute.
The GCN Radio Network, providing the world with hard-hitting talk radio. GCN. Great talk radio starts here.
Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. A couple of notes here in our concluding segment. Remember, Surviving the Cataclysm, your guide to the worst financial crisis in human history, available from www.progressivepress.com. Those of you who have ordered copies, the paper editions will be forthcoming shortly. We've also got Obama the Postmodern Coup, The Making of a Manchurian Candidate. Get that from Amazon.com. And Barack H. Obama, The Unauthorized Biography. As the Obama illusion dissipates, as the standing in the polls craters, as the servitude towards Wall Street becomes more and more blatant, I think these are destined to have a significant impact on public opinion. Also, remember the Obama deception coming from Alex Jones at Infowars.com, very much the leading edge of the effort in the electronic and internet world with many millions of viewings, certainly in excess by now, I would guess, over 5 million and probably more. A couple of things. Ted Stevens of Alaska. How interesting. Senator Stevens, long-term corrupt Republican, right? Representative of the corrupt Republican machine of Alaska. But, as we well know, nobody gets indicted because they're corrupt. They get indicted because of a combination of political factors. So what was working with Ted Stevens? Notice what we've now found. That the prosecutor's team in the Ted Stevens case, which was it's a group of people from the public responsibility office, the public integrity office, Brenda Morris and her team were able to get Ted Stevens convicted by only by withholding exculpatory evidence and by lying about their contacts with their star witness, some dubious character that they brought in. And now the conviction of Ted Stevens has been thrown out, and we've got Judge Emmett Sullivan here in Washington, D.C., saying that this is the worst case of prosecutorial misconduct that he's seen in 25 years. It was absolutely outrageous. He has named a special prosecutor, and it's quite possible that Brenda Morris and her team will be indicted for violations of law, or they may be disbarred or otherwise thrown out of their jobs. The heat, of course, then goes to Eric Holder, the Attorney General under the Obama regime. But I think this is very interesting to ponder. This shows you how the U.S. ruling class works. The U.S. ruling class in 2007-2008 decided collectively that the right-cover neocon approach to governance was a failure. That is, it had exhausted itself in any case. Not so much failure, but it was no longer practical to continue in that fixed mode. So they decided to reverse their field, right? And the single-wing football metaphor, they decided to have a double reverse and put on a left-wing cover regime, which meant, therefore, that a lot of the pillars of the old right-wing Republican domination had to be gotten rid of. They're going to bring in Obama to replace Bush, and at the same time, they've got to clean out and destroy some of the congressional people that might become centers of opposition to the Barkey regime. And that meant, therefore, Ted Stevens. And I, at the time, I think I pointed to the fact the FBI is, of course, used as a political police in this regard, along with other agencies. Look what happened to Senator Torricelli of New Jersey, Democrat of New Jersey. Senator Torricelli, corrupt as you want. That's not the fact, not the point. They're all corrupt. That doesn't vary too much from individual to individual. But Torricelli, what was his big crime? He demanded an immediate, serious board of inquiry into 9/11. Immediate and serious. And that, of course, was too much. So when it came time for him to get reelected shortly thereafter, FBI comes forward, makes all kinds of wild accusations that are leaked out, and of course he's got to drop out of contention for the Senate seat. He has never been prosecuted. So the FBI did a number on Torricelli. Another case, Congressman Weldon, Republican now, reactionary, from Pennsylvania, also, you know, corrupt, whatever you want. The idea was that his daughter had contacts, I think it was with Turkey or something like this. But in the course of his election campaign, 2006 now, the FBI comes forward, the Department of Justice. They leak all kinds of stuff. Wild accusations fly. Weldon, as far as I can see, has never been indicted for anything. So here we have two leading politicians essentially wrapped up by these police state methods. Ted Stevens, of course, it went further. They actually did get a conviction. This was a show trial, which was it was part of the atmosphere of communicating to people in general that the ruling class wanted the Republicans out and the Democrats in. They had enough of the neocon rule, and it was time for the corporate state under left cover. And that's what Ted Stevens fell victim to. So here we see the way in which the Anglo-American ruling class actually carries on government. Now, today, Good Friday, best wishes to Christians celebrating Easter, best wishes to those celebrating Passover. The two are linked, as we are reminded on Maundy Thursday, the day before I'm recording this program. I would like to ponder for a second the bankruptcy of vulgar atheism. And this comes up in the question of this film, Zeitgeist, in which I appear, although I do not share much of the thesis of this film. Vulgar atheism is, of course, the attempt to create a new pseudo or ersatz religion. It makes atheism into a religion. In other words, instead of saying there is a God and that's religion, it makes there is no God into a religion. And, of course, the greatest modern exponents of this are somebody like Nietzsche, right? The famous God is dead and therefore you can get away with anything. The results of this have generally not been very good. I would also point out people came into the 9/11 truth movement with other issues, fundamentally extraneous issues. We had one person who attracted a lot of attention saying it was time for 9/11 truth and peak oil. Well, peak oil is a fraud. Global warming is a fraud. You could say 9/11 truth and global warming, a fraud. Now we've got 9/11 truth plus atheism. not needed. Vulgar atheism adds nothing to your argument. And what we've got to point to is the fact that the leading intelligence agencies and political factions of the world, on the negative side, are perfectly happy with this stuff. And that would include, let's take the case of Robert Kaplan of the Atlantic Monthly, leading neocon, and his book, I've mentioned it before, Warrior Values, Warrior Politics, I guess it's called. And in here, we have this interesting attempt by Kaplan to rehabilitate, of all people, the Emperor Tiberius. And here on Good Friday afternoon, think about what this meant. The crucifixion of Christ was carried out under the Roman governor of Judea, Pontius Pilate. Pontius Pilate was the son-in-law of the Emperor Tiberius. Tiberius, of course, was a monster whose pastimes included throwing people to their deaths off the rocks of the island of Capri, where he lived, other kinds of shenanigans in the Blue Grotto of Capri. You can look this up, related stuff. It was the Tiberius administration, with their local prosecutor, Pontius Pilate, that carried out this act of deicide, the killing of God. But Kaplan says, no, Tiberius has gotten a bum rap. Let's give him the benefit of the doubt. He was really a good administrator. What this reflected, and that's Kaplan's theme in the book, is that Christianity got in the way of the successful prosecution of the war on terror. We've also got the drunken Marxist Christopher Hitchens attacking Christianity as somebody who believes in spirits rather than the Holy Spirit. So the drunken Marxist Hitchens, joined by the attack dog Dawkins, a Darwinian attack dog, a big devotee of Darwin. This kind of stuff gets you nowhere, and it's better to have no part of it. So happy Easter, happy Passover to all, and we hope to be back next week.